quality. And we'll start off with Paul. Would you give us fiscal's report?
Sure, certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have gotten a packet on Friday with a cover memo for the orientation and background. I'll just go through this rather briefly because we will have the Department of Administrative Services analyst talking about the governor's budget as soon as I'm done. The first slide gives you a very quick overview of the governor's budget. As you can see, general fund and lottery funds make up just a small portion of the department's overall budget. The next slide goes briefly through the mission and purpose of the department. I know the department was spending quite a bit of time going over these pieces in their presentation later. The third slide is a breakdown of the operating budget, which is all funds except for the non-limited funding in the department. You can see that general fund is only less than 18% of the total department's budget. Again, this is without the non-limited expenditures. Well, you have a slide that will break up the proportions of the different divisions and the program units within the budget. You see that land quality is the largest budget unit within the Department of Environmental Quality, and with water quality and air quality being just about the same size. The next slide shows the funding types over the last number of biennia. You can see the heading says that the state support for DEQ's operating budget had been gradually rising. That was until this biennium. The very bottom portion of this bar chart is the general fund lottery fund. But you can see that on an overall basis that had been rising slowly, but the proportion of the state support for the overall budget has been going down over the last few biennia.
Mr. Chair, do you have a lot of questions or do you want to send them?
Why don't we wait until he's done with his presentation?
Okay. The very last slide has some of the budget and policy issues that you will be dealing with during these hearings. The TMDL completion schedule, the last legislature, and during the interim, the emergency board was interested in looking at privatization of the vehicle inspection program. You also have some increase in DEQ laboratory rent and the construction of a new lab. There is no debt service funding in this budget, but that would begin in 05-07. Construction is due to begin in 03-05 biennium. The possibility of shifting some of the Oregon plan activities to other sources besides general fund, those being Measure 66 lottery funds and federal funds. There's been a revenue shortfall in land quality division over the interim, which I know the department will be addressing in their overview. And then the restructuring of the state clean water revolving fund debt service. The governor's budget has, using some of the interest paid by the persons taking these loans to pay for debt service instead of using general fund or lottery fund, which has been the case in the past. Quickly, the other attachments are a copy of LFO's analysis of the governor's budget, which hopefully you've had a chance to at least look through briefly, a memo that's followed by a memo that contains the budget notes from the 0103 budget, which was Senate Bill 5517. The only really relevant Secretary of State audit is attached, which is an audit of Measure 66 funding. And then there's on the back side of that is a copy of a letter from the Secretary of State to the department that briefly summarizes the findings of the audit. There are a whole series of executive summaries from interim reports. The department is required by statute to make a number of reports to the legislature every 2 years. So most of these are January of 03 reports. You have just the executive summaries here. I have copies of the original. I can get you a copy of the whole report if you'd like that. I'm sure the department can as well. as a series of reports, which are followed by copies of two of the department's fee bills. The first is Senate Bill 196. This is would set in statute hazardous waste generation fees. I believe this bill is still before the Senate committee. And then Senate Bill 197 is the fee ratification bill for the department. We will be amending this bill into, my understanding is it'll be House Bill 5019 into a budget bill, but it was introduced erroneously as Senate Bill 197, so we can take care of that when we go to work session by taking this bill and inserting it into another 5500 or 5000 series bill. And again, that's just the fee ratification of fees that were set administratively during the interim, which the department had the approval of the 2001 legislature to raise. Finally, there are a number of emergency board actions that were taken during the interim. I've attached minutes for those. This is not the all the actions that were taken, but you'll see here a number of actions in which you will be asked to take some further steps for the governor's 03-05 budget. For example, the National Environmental Information Exchange Network grant. There's some more work that will be done in 03-05 that the department will be asking for limitation for. Vehicle inspection program, again, we've discussed that. And some pollution control tax credit applications, which I believe will be rolling forward into 03-05. And with that, that's my brief overview.
Thank you, Paul. Representative Morgan.
Taking us way back to the pie mm-hmm. chart that outlines the operating budgets and the percentages of the budgets that they take up, in the agency management piece of the pie, does that include the management functions in the three quality programs too, or is that just the programs that go over top of all of the budgets, like payroll and accounting and that kind of thing?
Yes, the latter is correct. So, for example, the administrator of the air quality division would be in that piece of the pie that's for the air quality division.
Okay.
Any other questions, Paul? Well, I don't know whether it's appropriate at this time, but maybe you can clarify. On Senate Bill 196, have there been amendments as to where those funds would be deposited?
I believe that the Senate committee is entertaining some amendments. Most of the conversation I saw in the policy committee were over the provision that establishes the Hazardous Waste Technical Assistance Fund and has the penalties that the department levies and that are collected going into that fund to fund department program activities, assistance activities. The committee had some concerns over breaking what is not uniformly, but is a pretty standard policy of having penalties go into the general fund rather than having them go into to fund programs that the agency operates directly.
Thank you, and that's what I was referring to. So. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call Lisa Pearson. Would you like to give us a report from BAM?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Pearson of the Department of Administrative Services. And you should have a document that looks like this in front of you. And I'll real quickly go through this so that we can get to the main event. Starting on page 2, you'll find the standard chart of historical expenditures for the agency. There is about a 10% decrease in total funds from the fifth special session to the governor's balanced budget. That's nearly a 12% decrease in general fund, a 20% decrease in lottery funds, and this results from the reversal of some short-term fund shifts that were taken in the second special session, as well as moving the Lower Columbia River Estuary Program from this agency to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. There's a 2% increase in other funds, a 9.6% increase in federal funds, which is primarily because of a base change in the way that the base grant was put together from the federal government. And then there's a 28% decrease in other funds non-limited, which is the biggest driver in the decrease in total funds. And this results from the elimination of companion loans, orphan site bonding, and there's also a 4.7% decrease in full-time equivalents. Turning to page 3, this is a pie chart that we essentially just saw from Mr. Stewart, showing the split of fund types that support the agency's operations and expenditures. Other funds come primarily from regulation and permit fees, loan proceeds, charges for services, and there are some miscellaneous sources. The other funds non-limited mainly involves the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and loan programs. And this program helps with wastewater collection, treatment, and disposal systems, non-point source water pollution control, and implementation of federally designated estuaries. Is a program that has a 1-to-5 match ratio. So for every $1 spent by the state, there's approximately $5 of federal money that comes in available to us, and it helps out municipal and community wastewater treatment. Federal funds mainly come from the Environmental Protection Agency under the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. Moving to page 4, this slide summarizes the governor's balanced budget. It is a 10% decrease approximately from the fifth special session. Major changes include reductions from the special sessions of the past year. There were reductions to total maximum daily load planning, wastewater permitting, stormwater phase 2, phase 2 of the, eliminate use attainability analysis, air quality emissions testing, which is really an efficiency streamlining effort. And then also there were included in the governor's budget were the Willamette Total Maximum Daily Load Plan development for the completion of the plans through the end of this calendar year, and also to continue the vehicle inspection program with state staff rather than contracted staff or privatizing it. Moving on to page 5. This pie chart again shows the different programs and how they comprise the total budget. Non-limited debt service is by far the biggest portion of the budet. It's about 34% of the budget, 66% approximately is operating, and the operating portion consists of the air, water, land, and cross-media agency management pieces. Moving to page 6, this pie chart shows the major categories of expenditure. The major category is personal services, followed by special payments, which are primarily the revolving loan funds, et cetera, that we talked about with the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and some of the other bonding programs. That's followed by services and supplies, which supports the work that the agency does. Debt service is for the bonding that has gone on in the past and a bit for the future that supports orphan site bond program, also the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. So it basically has been bonding to capitalize funds in order to provide loans and grants to communities. Moving to page 7. This slide summarizes how the governor's balanced budget was adopted or created, and it was starting with the adopted budget from the 2001 legislative session. The special session 2 reductions were incorporated. For the most part, there were some short-term reductions that were brought back in, and that will be on the next page. Emergency boards include the John Day Basin Water Quality Assessment Project and the National Environmental Exchange Network project, which Mr. Siebert mentioned. Turning to page 8, this agency had some non-position information control system personal service vacancy factor adjustments, and those were for shift differentials, overtime, temporary appointments, mass transit, unemployment assessments, and there was a vacancy savings increase. The O2O package includes the phase-in of those short-term special session 2 reductions, as well as a phase-in of reduction that delayed the sale of orphan site bonding, and that brings that debt service back into the budget in full force. There are some phase-outs, including the Community Solutions Team, total maximum daily load plan development, the portion that is federally funded and that will come back in a policy package in a moment. The Lapine on-site disposal project, again, federally funded. The air toxic program, source water assessments, which again is federally funded. Air quality energy expediting, which was a reaction to the energy crisis in 2001. There was an effort to expedite the siting of energy producers. The underground storage tanks have sort of phased out, and there is some continuation in that program. And then the bonding programs where debt was issued and to capitalize the funds, those phase out because those bonds and other instruments have been issued. There are inflation and price list adjustments in this agency's budget. Again, natural resources agencies did not have a reduction to inflation as was done in the big three general fund policy areas, but this is something that will be adjusted as we move towards work session. And then fund shifts were reversed, and this would be the fund shifts from special session two, where funding was moved around in order to generate general fund savings, and that was reversed going into the future. On page 9, we start the policy packages, including the first policy package, which is revenue shortfalls. And here you see a number of reductions to program in order to get expenditures to match current law revenues. And for the most part, this has to do with the need to have this legislative body ratify fee increases that were approved by the 2001 legislature but were adopted during the interim. And Senate Bill 333 in 1995 said that the agencies would have to come back in and subsequent biennium, or excuse me, legislative sessions and request that those be ratified. So that affects air quality, air contaminant discharge permits, vehicle inspection fees, water quality wastewater permitting, wastewater operator certification, orphan site cleanup reductions, dry cleaners, hazardous waste, and solid waste fee revenue declines, and there's a decline in the hazardous waste dumping that has occurred as a result of lowered economic activity because aluminum smelters have not been operating at the capacity they once did, and that will come up with Package 131. There was a reduction to cross-media for the Pollution Prevention in States Grants Program that phased out. And then also there was a phase-out of indirect support for agency management because there were a significant number of limited duration positions in the 2001-03 budget. And because that funding source went away, there were reductions taken in agency management to somewhat match up the expected workload demand from program with agency management. That leads to Package 081, which was the standard salary range 38 and above salary adjustment, where folks who are at salary range 38 and above did not get the cost of living adjustment that other employees did. That brings us to page 10. There is a program reduction. The Oregon Hazardous Waste Information Management Exchange system, computer system, was reduced in Special Session 2, and it was interpreted by some to be a short-term reduction. We went ahead and talked with LFO and determined that it was a long-term reduction, so we brought that back in Governor's Balance Budget. And then the 091 package is the fifth special session. It incorporates the agency's plans to meet the across-the-board reductions target that was established by House Bill 5100. And that affects air quality. It continues air quality streamlining efforts in order to reduce costs. It affects water quality monitoring, biomonitoring, wastewater permitting, use attainability analysis, date management, groundwater standards and assessments, and total maximum daily load developments. It affects cleanup and spills work reduction, and it also has a community solutions team reduction. The 092 additional program reduction is, frankly, an alternative that the agency proposed in order to avoid some of the wastewater permit reductions in Package 091. But because of the extreme nature of the fiscal crisis that became apparent last fall, we also incorporated the substitute reduction. So this agency actually took more of a reduction than perhaps the typical agency in general fund. Moving to the next page, page 11, we start the traditional policy packages, and I've clumped them under thematic headings. The first group are those fee changes requiring ratification under Senate Bill 333, and that includes packages 101, 102, 103, and 104. And again, these are the fee increases that were approved at least implicitly in the 2001-03 budget, but do need to be ratified by the legislature in order to become permanent. Just as a reminder, the air contaminant discharge permit fee ratification, the percentage increase there was a 30% increase that was approved. The wastewater permitting fee ratification was a 20% overall increase that was approved during the 2001 session. And the Package 104, the Auto Dealer On-Site Vehicle Inspection Program, was a new program as of 2001-03 to allow the agency to go out and expedite things for auto dealers, and that's a $26 per vehicle fee. The next clump of policy packages are revenue shortfall issues, and this takes us to those items that were reduced in the governor's balanced budget because of actual classic revenue shortfalls. And the first one is the Package 131, and that's the one where the hazardous waste dumping has gone down primarily because of a loss of economic activity with aluminum smelters. And the agency does not foresee that bouncing back anytime soon, so there is this effort to go ahead and adjust the fees in order to keep the program going. And this will be discussed in much greater detail as the agency goes through its presentation. And then Package 165 restores four positions in agency management. This is reflecting the fact that the governor's balanced budget brings positions back online in policy packages that did go away at the end of this biennium, or would go away at the end of this biennium, and if we bring them back on board, then the presumption is that there would be a workload for agency administration that would accompany that. So that brings these positions in order to meet that workload back in. The next clump of packages has to do with the laboratory space. The agency has been renting space from Portland State University since the mid-1970s and has had a longstanding lease agreement with Portland State, which actually has been extended, I believe, a couple of times. But Portland State is very anxious to get a hold of that space. The lease rate is not as favorable as it once was, and the agency has also grown its laboratory, or its laboratory has grown over time, so there is some additional need for space. So there is a couple factors going on here. One is that the lease rate has gone up, and also that the per square footage has gone up. This is really a bridge between the current space and what the agency hopes is new space, along with the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Siebert did mention that the Department of Administrative Services has an item in its facilities construction budget. Right now it stands at about $32 million, and it would be funded by certificates of participation, which would start being paid off in the 2005-07 biennium budget. At this point, there is nothing in the 2003-05 biennium budget for debt service because it wouldn't become due until 2005-07. But that will be discussed much more in detail by the agency as well. Page 12 brings us to a number of water quality issues, and these continue 2001-03 programs. And primarily, as you can read through, packages 120, 122, 123, 125, 129, and 143, most of these have to do with federal funds, except for package 129, and most of them involved some combination of limited duration positions. So by definition, the limited duration positions would go away at the end of this biennium, and in order to continue the work, the expenditure limitation and position authority would need to be restored. Moving to page 13, there are some changes from past practice that also involve water quality, and this includes package 124, which would establish a Clean Water State Revolving Fund Program Coordinator position, and that position would be available to manage the growing portfolio of loans to municipalities under the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And then, as I mentioned earlier, Package 180 would move the Lower Columbia River Estuary Program to the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. It was felt that that's probably a better place for it to be in terms of policy. And also, the source of funding has been the Measure 66 ballot measure funds. And so since OWEB is the primary initial recipient, at least of those, and administers those, it was felt that that would be a better place for that program. That brings us to air quality issues. Again, the next round, packages 112 and 113, would continue the 2001-03 programs. It continues the federally funded particulate monitoring program, PM2.5, but it would convert some limited duration positions and temporaries to permanent positions because it now appears that the workload will continue for some time in the future and that the funding is stable. And then the Package 113 brings the vehicle inspection program back to having state employees rather than contract employees. That limited duration positions for the 2001-03 biennium, again, by their nature, they went away or would go away at the end of this current biennium, and the whole thing would revert to contracts as it had been in the past prior to the 2001-03 biennium. And this package would restore the positions, with 20 of the positions becoming permanent based on expected workload, and then 50 would continue to be limited duration. The next set of packages continue agency efforts. The first one, the Umatilla Compliance, Package 136, uses federal funds in order to ensure public safety, and that would include an administrative law specialist and an inspector. Package 151 continues the federally funded grant to improve data sharing capabilities with federal EPA. That was an e-board action that was taken during this biennium. It phased out, and it's being brought back on board here. And then Package 152 responds to an increase in requests for pollution control tax credits. The agency has experienced a greater than expected increase in the number of applications, and so a position would be added to handle that workload. That takes us to page 14. And on that page, we see that there's a Package 167, which would be a facilities coordinator to handle the leases that the agency has entered into and also do some facilities planning. Package 191 is getting back to the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, and that one would provide the debt service, as Mr. Siebert mentioned, not from general fund or lottery funds, as has traditionally been the case, but from interest earnings and basically user support. And Package 192 actually provides the bonding expenditure limitation that would capitalize the fund for the next round of loans from the program. As Mr. Siebert again mentioned earlier, there are two bills that have to do with fees. The first one, Senate Bill 196, is attached to Package 131, the Hazardous Waste Program. And Package 197 ratifies the existing fees, so a large number of the packages in this budget do in fact depend upon Package 197, Senate Bill 197 being passed. There are no governor's investments or new programs. Everything is essentially a continuation of what has gone on in 2001-03. With the exception, for example, of the facilities coordinator and the rent. But other than that, everything is a response to essentially limited duration positions going away or changes, phase outs because of grants, that sort of thing. And so with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or we could actually move on to the agency's presentation.
Lisa, I just want to make it clear. I think I heard you say it, but this budget does not yet include the governor's reductions in compensation, then, is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The merit changes have not been incorporated yet, but we are working now on getting that put together with legislative fiscal and going through the details of that. So that should be ready for work session. And the cost of living adjustments were not factored in. They were separately budgeted in a different section of the overall state budget. So that will also be taken care of. And again, this agency, along with other natural resource agencies, did not have adjustments to inflation like public safety, education, and human services did. But that should be incorporated as well as we move into work session.
Second question on policy package 180. Mm-hmm. What was the justification of shifting those funds to OWEB as opposed to Department of Fish and Wildlife?
Mr. Chair, at the time that the budget was being put together, the concept of actually, there are a couple of bills I'm sure you're aware of that would actually eliminate the Watershed Enhancement Board and move the bulk of its activities over to Fish and Wildlife. That hadn't arisen yet as an option, and so simply because OWEB is in fact the primary recipient of the water or the Measure 66 funds before they're allocated out to other agencies, it was moved over there.
Okay, and I don't want to suggest to anyone on this watching or listening that that's a direction that this body or that the legislature is going to take, but I know there are other bills in other areas that are considering putting fisheries issues with the Fish and Wildlife Department. So, Representative Morgan, do you have a question?
It's just kind of a technical question. I'm back to the pie charts again. And the LFO pie chart is 189.7, and the BAM pie chart is 273.9, which can clearly relate to the total funding number. Where is this number?
That is the budget without the non-limited. So that's what we call that. It says the operating budget. So that's everything, but it excludes the non-limited line there. Other funds, non-limited expenditures.
So the $84.2 million, mm-hmm, non-limited?
Yeah. And it could be even more confusing, I believe, when the department talks about their budget. They'll be talking about an operating budget that excludes non-limited and debt service as well. Traditionally, when we're talking about the operating budget, we don't include the non-limited expenditures. We just talk about expenditures that the body limits.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In this budget, sorry. Next, I'd like to call Stephanie Hollick and whoever else you might want to bring to the table with you. Brave soul,
you can do it yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you'll see, I have the first string lined up behind me, so when I get in too much trouble, I'm sure they'll dive in here and save me. For the record, I'm Stephanie Halleck, and I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality. And the handout, I hope that Paul has passed around there, is what good I'm going to be talking from, and that would be tab 2 of this large binder that you should also have that we'll be, I'll be referring to and cross-referencing as needed. And I think you also have a copy of the governor's actual balance budget, and if you have any questions that pertain to that document, we'll be happy to answer those as well. My presentation today is going to follow the format of the four questions that were posed to us by the co-chairs. Why does the agency exist? How has the agency been performing? How does the agency use its budget? And what results can be expected from the budget request? And I would just like to mention that it was very helpful to us to have those questions and really know in organizing this presentation what it is that you are interested in hearing from us. We're a large agency with a very complicated budget, and it was extremely helpful to have those questions to put it together, and I hope that we were successful in doing so. I'm going to start in response to the question of why the agency exists with just a little bit of history. The mission statement that we have to be a leader in restoring, maintaining, and enhancing the quality of Oregon's air, water, and land has been the mission statement since I've been with the agency for almost 15 years. We have developed a vision in the last couple of years of accomplishing that mission by working cooperatively with all Oregonians for a healthy, sustainable environment. We strive to achieve our mission and vision through our strategic priorities, and I think you have all been over those with me. They are in the binder in Appendix A02, delivering excellence in performance and product, protecting Oregon's water, protecting human health and the environment from toxics, and engaging Oregonians in solving environmental problems are our four strategic priorities. We're also in the process of doing what I would call transforming our agency to make it easier to do business with DEQ, to streamline our regulatory processes to save time and money, and to improve our customer service. And Appendix A05 in the large binder provides a progress report on some of our transformation efforts to date. DEQ's history, the need to protect the environment has been recognized in Oregon for a long time, beginning in the early 1900s, primarily around the Willamette Valley and the Willamette River, when there was a fair amount of pollution by municipalities and industry at that time of the river. Pulp mills, slaughterhouses, some of the cities that were developing in the Willamette Valley. The State Sanitary Authority was created in 1938, but really had very little power to do anything. A study came out, or it was then called Oregon State College, in 1944, did a study of the whole Willamette River from the headwaters down to the confluence with Columbia, and basically declared the river dying as it got to the Oregon City Falls, and dead when it got through the Portland Harbor. And dead in that context meant that there was no oxygen to support aquatic life. The real effort to clean up the river did not start until the early 1960s, and that was largely due, as I'm sure you know, to the efforts of then-Governor Tom McCall. And there was an increase, in addition to concern about pollution of the Willamette River, there was increased concern about air quality, both from fuel burning and also from industrial pollution in the 50s and 60s. In 1963, the first bill was passed to give the State Sanitary Authority some power, and they were, in fact, given the power to the Sanitary Authority to shut down polluting companies. And I might mention that that legislation was sponsored by State Senator Ted Halleck. In 1967, Governor McCall himself took over the State Sanitary Authority because he was not satisfied with the efforts that were being made. Although in 64, after the legislation was passed, the Sanitary Authority did in fact order some dramatic cleanup efforts, and progress started to be made on cleaning up the river.
I have to ask you, Stephanie, are you declaring conflict here?
Absolutely not, Senator.
In 1969, at the same time that the U.S. Congress created the Environmental Protection Agency, the state of Oregon created the Department of Environmental Quality with a citizen oversight body, the Environmental Quality Commission. And under Governor McCaul, his chief of staff, Cass Cannon, ran the department for a couple of years. And in 1971, Governor McCaul appointed the now legendary L.B. Day as the first director of DEQ. And in 1972, there was a feature in the National Geographic magazine featuring the comeback of the Willamette River and the improvements that had been made since 1964. When DEQ came into being, it largely started out by adopting federal programs. The federal government, on roughly the same parallel track as the evolution of the state DEQ, passed the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and subsequently the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. And when Congress did that, they designed those acts to be administered by the states, and they hoped and encouraged with dollars that the states would accept delegation of these programs. And as an example of that, in 65 and 67, when it was still a state sanitary authority, there was only a budget of $1 million in the state devoted to environmental activities. In 1972 and 73, the legislature in Oregon approved a budget of $39 million for DEQ. And I would just mention that DEQ at this time has adopted or is in the process of adopting all of the delegable programs from the federal EPA. In addition to the federal acts, the state of Oregon itself has adopted a number of state programs over the years. The first of these was in 1971, the Bottle Bill, and even though DEQ does not administer the Bottle Bill, in a sense it set the tone for Oregon's reputation as an environmental leader, and there were a series of waste and recycling bills that the state legislature adopted subsequent to that that DEQ does administer, most notably the State Opportunity to Recycle Act in 1983. As DEQ was initially formed, the septic tank program in 1973 was moved over to DEQ from the Health Division. There had been some problems with regulation, and they'd actually had a hepatitis outbreak in Jackson County that was linked to failing on-site systems, and so that program was moved to DEQ. And that same year, the Columbia-Willamette Air Pollution Authority merged with DEQ as really the two founding solid programs in addition to the federal programs. We then went on to have a state cleanup program in 1987 to supplement the federal Superfund program, and that program was then revised in 95. A toxics use reduction program in 1989 that established technical assistance efforts at DEQ to help businesses reduce the toxic chemicals in their production processes. State. Thank you. And then finally, the Groundwater Management Protection Act in 1989 came out of the recognition that the state did not have an overall strategy to protect groundwater, and that, of course, is a source of drinking water in much of the state. So today, DEQ, in terms of why we exist, is focusing on maintaining the environmental accomplishments that we have made over the years in protecting public health and providing clean water, air, and land. And today we're focusing more on enhancing services that make it easier for businesses to locate and thrive in Oregon and keeping delegation of these federal programs and carrying out federal environmental laws in Oregon. The focus that we face today is reflected, I hope, in the results that we will be talking about with you today that we want to achieve from our budget when we get to question four that the co-chairs posed, and also in our efforts to transform the agency, and my reference to that is Appendix A05. And we hope today to be a partner in building a strong, sustainable economy while fulfilling our responsibility to provide a healthy, sustainable environment. And what I'm going to do now is shift to an overview of each of the programs and the second question that the co-chairs posed, which is how has the agency been performing? And I'm going to talk about each program in the context of environmental effectiveness and operational effectiveness. And then I'll discuss some overall improvements to the agency. And in this section, I'll be talking about performance measures and benchmarks for each program, as well as how we are responding to complaints and concerns about our services. You might want to refer to Appendix A03 in the binder, which contains our benchmarks and performance measures. And I also, Holly Schroeder has a handout for you, a one-pager, with regard to customer service feedback and how we respond to complaints about the environment. Now, with any luck at all, we're all on the same page here. And that would be page 6 of my presentation. And I'm going to talk a little bit about environmental effectiveness in air quality. In your big binder, tab 5 provides all of the background general information on the air quality program. In terms of environmental effectiveness in this program, Oregon has clean air, and I think we can be very proud of that. We currently meet the federal health standards for all pollutants throughout the state, and our challenge is to keep it that way, to protect the public's health and to ensure the capacity for economic development. As you can see from the handout, we do have some areas of the state that have had exceedances and do bump up against the standards from time to time, and we need to carefully monitor to make sure that we do not exceed the standards in those areas. One of the key differences from the earlier history that I was telling you about is today only 5 to 10% of air pollution comes from industrial point sources that are regulated by DEQ. 45 to 55% of the pollution comes from cars, trucks, and other mobile sources, and that is one of the reasons that the vehicle inspection program is so important in the metropolitan Portland area and in the Medford area to keep us in compliance with the air quality standards. The closer we bump up to the ceiling, the less capacity there is for industrial growth in those areas. And 35 to 45% comes from burning and other consumer activities. An example would be some years ago when we were having problems down in southern Oregon with wood stove air pollution. There was a huge effort down there and a big wood stove buyout program so that the cleaner stoves have now solved that problem. And as you can also see on the one-page complaint sheet that I handed out, a number of the complaints that we actually investigate are with regard to open burning. And I would also just remind you that even though when DEQ started, one of the main reasons it started was because of concerns about field burning, a number of sessions ago that program has been shifted to the Department of Agriculture and we no longer administer that program. In terms of operational effectiveness, I would refer you in the Air Quality tab 5 to page 21 and also in the Agency Overview tab 4, page 17 and 18. They describe an effort that our air quality program undertook to completely overhaul its the permitting structure and the fee structure for the air contaminant discharge permits that the state administers. And over a 3 or 4 year period, the air program worked with stakeholders and substantially streamlined that program and simplified the fee schedules. As a result of that effort, 68% of the state air permits have changed from individual, more complex permits to simpler general permits. Before that streamlining effort, the average issuance target was 167 days from receipt of application, and after streamlining, air quality has dropped that issuance target to 69 days. And even though they've tightened up the timelines, they are still issuing a higher percentage of permits within the timeline just because of streamlining efforts that the program has made. There is a customer service survey result, the very final appendix in your binder. It's appendix AM3. In response to a budget note and also as follow-up to a survey we did in 96, we did another customer service survey, and the comment that was made in here about 70% of air quality permittees say that DEQ service is good or excellent comes from that survey. And I've also linked you, I've tried to link you program by program here to the performance measures and the benchmarks that connect to each one of these accomplishments that I'm talking about.
Stephanie, could I back you up to
yes.
Our page 6? Mm-hmm. You're talking about communities at risk, Klamath Falls, Hillsborough, Northridge. What is PM 2.5?
Particulate matter, Senator Messerly. It's generally from slash burning or field burning. It's smoke, dust, that kind of thing. And 2.5 refers to the actual size of the particulate microns.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator, you
A follow-up on that. It just strikes me as odd that Hillsborough should be subject to air degradation as a result of particulate when so much of our high tech is focused in that area, and I would presume that the technology, the clean rooms, and the rest of that help scour the air. But could you explain a little bit about the Hillsborough situation?
Representative Johnson and Chair Messerly, Andy Ginsberg, my air quality administrator, is here, and he probably has a much more precise answer. But I would assume that it comes also from the agricultural activity that goes on in Washington County, and also sometimes from smoke management, just any burning that goes on in the mountains. But is that anything else, Andy? Okay.
Thank you.
And we can get more into depth on that when he gives his report, I'm sure. Okay.
Unless there are further questions on air quality, I'm going to move into the performance in the water quality program.
And what page are you on?
I'm on page 8. The whole water quality program description is at tab 6 in your big binder. Water is obviously our most challenging program because of the multiple demands on our water supply and the fact that the availability of water is declining. In terms of the information I've provided you here, we measure improving or declining water quality at monitoring points throughout the state. Where we don't monitor, we don't have data. We have 151 monitoring sites. They are roughly two-thirds of them are on the west side of the mountains, and a third of them are on the east side of the mountains. And we get data from those anywhere from 6 to 12 times per year. And from that monitoring, we derive what is called the Oregon Water Quality Index that looks at water chemistry. It does not specifically address toxics, and one of the increased concerns we have, historically, the kind of monitoring and the kind of pollution tracking that has been done has not included toxics. It's a different kind of equipment. It's a complete different focus than the work of the lab to date. And as we look to the future and we're worried about things like pharmaceuticals in the water supply, some of the toxics that are left from legacy and the sediment, we obviously have to figure out how to get more information on the toxics that are in our water bodies. But in terms of what this slide shows you, what the water quality index means, when you say if water is improving, it means that over time at that particular site where we do monitoring, that the water quality index is showing improvement or is showing that it is declining. The other point I would make with regard to water, much like with air quality, the source of pollution has changed over time. It is no longer the big industrial or municipal point sources that are providing most of the pollution. Most of the pollution now in our water bodies nationally comes from runoff, either from the cities in the urban areas or rural, from agricultural forest practices. With regard to the communities, there is, and you've heard about the State Revolving Loan Fund earlier, that's the primary way that small communities get funding to upgrade their wastewater treatment plants. Nationally, there is a dearth of funding, and there is a problem, just like there is with the infrastructure of bridges in transportation. There is a dire need for funding for communities, small communities in particular, to upgrade treatment plants. In Oregon, we estimate it to be about a $1.5 billion need in 69 Oregon communities. I'd also like to hand out now, if Holly will do so, a copy of the map that shows the TMDL schedule that we're working on, and TMDL stands for total maximum daily load of pollution that a water body can handle. And what we have now on the most, what we have to submit to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency periodically is a listing of all the water bodies in the state that have impairment, and that is called the 303D list, which is refers to a section of the Clean Water Act that requires that report. This map shows you for the 13,000 river miles, which is 10% of all the river miles in Oregon, on the current 303D list. This is our schedule for completing the setting. We are required then to set pollutant loadings for those impaired water bodies, and this is our plan, if you will. I would point out that this plan reflects dates, a final completion date of 2007, which was a date that was established under the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. There is also a date in a consent agreement between EPA and the plaintiffs in a lawsuit of 2010. We currently are on schedule. We have met the 2004 target date, and our target for 2005 is to complete 41% of stream segments. I will say, however, that because of the budget reductions, we will not be able to meet a 2007 date, even if we wanted to. So we are now working against the 2010 date that's in the consent agreement, and hopeful at this point, if there are no further reductions in our TMDL program, that we will be able to make the 2010 date, and we will need to then revise this map to show when we are through the legislative session and we know what our resource picture looks like to show how we're going to achieve the 2010 date. There is also an interim date in the consent agreement of 2008 that we have to pay some attention to as well. Representative Morgan asked me at one point what happens if we don't aren't able to do the TMDLs. The short answer to that is the Environmental Protection Agency must do them. The consent agreement is not between us and EPA. It's between EPA and the plaintiffs. And we do these TMDLs in a memorandum of agreement with EPA, and if we can't do them, then EPA must do them.
Stephanie, did the consent agreement dictate the timeline that you would do each basin then, or how did they?
Senator Messerly, it did not have the timeline for each basin. It did have, I think, a certain number by certain dates, X number by 2004, X number by 2008, X number by 2010. And then the department within that was able to set the priority of the sub-basins.
What was the criteria for that?
Senator Messerly, I'm going to ask Mike Llewellyn from our Water Program Administrator.
Actually, if you'd rather wait until he gives his presentation, just make a note of that, please.
We have had, I would just want to share with you, we do have some success to report. One of the first TMDLs that was done was with the Tualatin River, and we've actually gotten rid of algal blooms and met standards for dissolved oxygen, pH, and changed sewage treatment plant permits and worked with farmers and others in that basin. So we've actually got, then there's reports on this if you're interested. We've actually seen that setting a TMDL can work when you implement it. Switching now to operational effectiveness in the water quality program. In 2000, I'm now on page 9. In 2000, we had an internal wastewater process improvement team. We came up with 19 recommendations, and I would point out again that the whole water quality program description is at tab 6. Of those 19 recommendations, we've been able to implement 5 of the improvements that were recommended. 5 are in process, and then we've had to delay 9 of those because of budget reductions. We have also recently formed an external Blue Ribbon Committee of stakeholders to take a whole program look at the wastewater program in the same way that Air Quality did in their program. One of the first tasks of this committee will be to take these 19 recommendations and look at the ones that we've not been able to implement and figure out how we might get there on some of those recommendations. The universe in of permits in water is quite large. There are 4,000 water quality permits. Our permit backlog is getting worse. It's 18% now, and it was 11% in 2001. Currently, we have 79 major source permits, municipal, industrial. 46 of those are backlog, or 58%, which is the highest backlog in the nation. Of the permits that we do get to, 51% of those permits are done within the target timelines. And you will notice in the customer service satisfaction survey, 60% of the customers with whom we work are happy with the performance. But needless to say, it's a big problem. EPA is going to do an audit of our waste product water program, and obviously we're very concerned about delegation and our ability to continue to do this work, and that's one of the reasons that I've put together this advisory committee with a hope that we do not have a proposal this session for a fee increase. My hope is that I'll be coming back to this body in 05-07 after the advisory committee has done its work with some kind of request for change or fee increase that we have stakeholder support for.
Thank you, Chair. I'm assuming that means that we spend the next 2 years with the federal government questioning whether or not we can do the job, and with a lot of major permit applications not responded to.
Senator Messerly,
I don't know how that doesn't sound like a good thing.
Senator Messerly and Senator Dukes, I would agree it's not a good thing. We do have, as a matter of policy, there's two things you should know. First of all, the statute allows that if a permit has reached its expiration date, it is still valid. And so just because we have expired permits doesn't mean that they are invalid, so that the permittees are, in fact, protected, even though whatever limits are set in the permit may not be accurate. So that is of some concern. The second thing is, as a matter of policy, and this gets back to what I was telling you about needing to somehow marry our concerns about economic development with protection of the environment, any new permit requests or requests for major modifications in any program at DEQ automatically go to the top, and then everybody else has to wait. And an example of that, very successful recent example of that, is the permit for Port Westward in St. Helens, or excuse me, Clatskanie. And another example was one we worked on, and my last point I wanted to make is that the way the water program survives now is on individual acts of heroism. Port Westward was one of them, and the Blue Heron permit was another when it was up a year or so ago, and we had lots of discussion on that. Another was when we had to figure out what to do about the aquatic herbicide application out of the Talent Irrigation District lawsuit, and a whole bunch of folks who wouldn't have been able to conduct their business if we hadn't figured out how to get a permit out the door to do that. And so that's what happens, is we drop other things and do the crises that come in the door, and that's just the way it is.
And I'm assuming that, I mean, can I assume that staffing is the answer? Or is there a smarter way of doing what we're doing?
Senator Messerly, Senator Dukes, I think you can safely say both, and that's one of the reasons that we are devoting. We did the initial analysis in 2000, where we came up with 19 recommendations of things we could change internally, and we've been able to do some of them. So there's no question that we can be more efficient, and we're striving to be. However, I must say that before last session, we had done, using workload models that US EPA has designed nationally for this purpose, an assessment of how many resources are needed to run a good wastewater program. And we came in with a fee increase request last session that would have added 12 positions to the program to do the permitting work. It was not fully funded. We, as you heard earlier, it was a 20% fee increase, which basically kept the program at current service level, because one of the things that compounds the problem is there's no inflationary roll-up in any of our fee programs, and so you keep getting behind. So when the fee increase was approved last time of 20%, it was really just enough to cover five people who are already working in the program and not add anybody new. This is why I'm doing a full program review.
Then I'm done. I can't blame you. If we didn't give the resources, then it's not your fault.
All right. Let's see. I think that's it on water quality. Unless there are any further questions, I'd move into our land quality.
Let's stop there and see if there are any questions on the committee. I have a couple, Stephanie. The on the water quality, you mentioned that we are improving the water quality in our streams. Is there have you got adequate background to get the baseline of what we're comparing against? And when you couple that with natural cycles and natural events and all those kind of things, can we definitely show trends in what our programs are doing? Or some of our other data that I've seen in other committees, sometimes you really question what is the baseline and what are we measuring this against.
Senator Mesley and members of the committee, I feel very comfortable that for the data associated with the monitoring, the 151 monitoring points that contribute to the water quality index, that is good data and we have good baseline. Some of those monitoring points have been there for years. I think maybe as far back as 40 years. But as I also said, we do not monitor everything. We only have 151 points. We're only monitoring some of the river miles in the state. So there's a whole bunch of the state for which we do not have data. So I would not even attempt to speak about the quality of the water in that part of the state.
But even those parts of the states are included on the 303D list, right?
Some are, yes. And the monitoring data information comes from other sources, as you know.
Okay. Second question, in regards to the TMDL, the lawsuit, the court action that was taken, I should say, and where is the department in relation to that court action that removed TMDLs from non-point sources?
Right, Senator Meserle, for any members of the committee who are not familiar with that was the Haas decision in Northeast Oregon, where a decision was made that the department did not have authority to enter into an agreement with US EPA to do TMDLs for streams that are non-point source only, on which there are no point sources. That decision has been appealed. I believe at this point it is back to where a stay was requested. I'm not a lawyer, so I'll stumble through this. A stay was requested back to the circuit court in Baker County, and the arguments have been heard, and the Baker County judge has yet to opine on that stay. If there is not a stay granted, then the state Department of Justice will be appealing to the next higher court. And that's where it sits now.
And so who appealed that?
The State of Oregon Department of Justice.
Representative Krueger.
Chair. Stephanie, on page 8 at the top is going back to where I think where Senator Casually was. 50% rivers are improving, 5% are declining. Do you have a list of those that we could get? And also, I'd be kind of interested if the 5%, if any of those are coastal streams, and what is the standard that's causing the decline? Is it mostly temperature?
Senator Meserle, Representative Krueger, yes, we can get a list. And do any of my technical gurus have the answer today, or will we,
no.
Do you want to get back? Okay, get back to you on that one.
Representative Johnson, you took a breath of air. Are you ready to ask a question?
I
can tell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just reflecting on the exchange that you had with Senator Dukes, and trying to ascertain when you don't have enough people to perform some of the statutory functions that you have or requirements from the feds, what happens in the absence of being able to perform those functions?
Senator Meserle, Representative Johnson, the short answer is, with regard to permitting, is the permits just sit there. And they may sit there for 5 or 10 years beyond however long ago it was that they expired. And the risk is that the risk can go two ways, one for the facility itself or for the environment in terms of point source permits, in that the pollutant loads that they have in their permits may be outdated or inaccurate. They may have done some upgrades to their facilities they're not getting credit for, or there may be more pollution going into the air and water than needs to be going in there. Fortunately, we don't have backlogs in air now because of the restructuring. So it's clearly not a good situation, I don't know the answer other than what we've discussed already in terms of more people or...
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Would it be conceivable to say that if the backlog becomes too great that we could see federal agencies stepping in?
Well, I do think, Representative Johnson, Senator Messerly, that as I mentioned, the US EPA is going to do an audit of our wastewater program, and they have, in fact, taken back programs in states where the states are not performing adequately, and obviously that is of concern when they audit our program. They are aware of this problem in Oregon. It's not going to be news to them. And as a matter of fact, at the last meeting of the Blue Ribbon Committee that we put together, Randy Smith, who's the head of the water program up at Seattle EPA, came down and spoke to the advisory committee and spoke about the fact that he was hopeful that we would get a good product out of this process that would help us get on track with the program.
Thank you.
Representative Craig, did you?
Okay. I move into land quality, which is page 10. The land quality program summary is at tab 7 of the big binder. And I would start again talking about environmental effectiveness. And I guess I would say, start by saying that many people are surprised to hear that DEQ plays an important role in protecting Oregonians and the environment from imminent harm. I don't think that's something that we are normally associated with. But, for example, our deputy director, Paul Sliman, is one of the members of the Governor's Security Council that was formed after September 11th. Obviously, one of our most important responsibilities is to regulate the storage and disposal of the chemical weapons stockpile and nerve agent that's at the Umatilla Army Depot. We have 12% of the nation's stockpile at the Army Depot. That is about a little over 2,220 munitions and about a little over 3,000 tons of GB, which is also known as sarin, VX, and the blister agent mustard. Currently, that facility is in trial burns, and they're scheduled to start agent operations at the end of 2003. We're operating under an international treaty that has a 2012 end date, which hopefully we will be able to meet. We do oversee the permits for that facility, and we work in close cooperation with Oregon Emergency Management, who is responsible for the emergency preparedness activities for that facility. Appendix A01 describes our emergency response duties in addition to overseeing the Umatilla Chemical Weapons Facility. We're on call 24/7 to respond to spills of hazardous chemicals spills on the roadways, and also we respond and we're responsible for overseeing marine spill planning. About 70% of the incident calls that come into the Oregon Emergency Response System come through DEQ. In 2002, we had 2,358 calls, and our typical number is around 2,000 calls. This one point I'd like to make is I think largely because most folks don't think of us as an emergency response agency, we have not received a lot of funding for this activity in the past. We had about $1 million of general fund. That's been cut in the latest round of budget cuts, but our responsibility for this activity has not been cut, and it's one of those things that does not go away, so we are simply going to shift money out of the Hazardous Substance Remedial Action Fund, which is our base cleanup program dollars. We're going to shift that into spill response so we can continue to do this work. The other thing that I would mention, we've heard about our laboratory. Our laboratory is the lab of first response for the FBI and for first responders. Any unknown chemicals or substances that they come across, they come to the lab. We had an incident this weekend, I think, in having to do with the Corvallis drinking water supply that our lab had to be on call for, and fortunately that turned out all right. But we do play a very important role, and our ability to do that is of great concern to us right now.
Stephanie, I hate to interrupt your presentation, but of those 2,358, how many of those are valid complaints? I'm sure there's a few of them that were somebody saw foam on water and it was a natural event or something.
Senator Messerly, I can get you the exact number from our folks, but we have to evaluate with ORS every single call that comes in. This does not mean that we make a decision to go out on every single one of those calls. We have a system where we evaluate whether or not there is a need to respond or not, and I can find out for you what percentage we actually have to go out on.
Thank you. Thanks.
Also in land quality and in terms of what we do environmentally, we're now on page 11. As I told you before, protecting Oregonians from toxics is one of our strategic priorities. And to do that, in addition to the imminent harm kinds of protection that I just discussed, it requires that we try and keep hazardous waste and toxic substances out of the environment in the first place, safely manage the waste that have made it into the environment, and also clean up the waste and toxics already in the environment from past practices. Our base hazardous waste program, if you will, and you heard a little bit about Senate Bill 196, is a regulatory program delegated by the federal government. We do have a federal grant for it, and then the base program is also funded by fees that the hazardous waste generators pay and that the permitted facilities pay. And that legislation does include a fee increase on the waste disposed at Arlington that has been supported by our stakeholders who do not want the federal government to run this program, that want us to keep delegation. The other thing we do in that program, however, that was alluded to earlier with regard to the redirection of the penalty money, is that we do technical assistance to hopefully keep generators of hazardous waste out of the compliance and enforcement system in the first place by going in. We have about 618 regulated generators and over 3,000 generators of hazardous waste, which we refer to as conditionally exempt in Oregon. And by way of technical assistance, an example is we conducted 720 site visits in 2001-03 to those generators to provide technical assistance on managing waste. We have also scheduled conferences and training for them to come to as well. So Senate Bill 196 is very important, I think, to us on a variety of fronts. As I mentioned, we do cleanup. In 2002, 465 contaminated sites were cleaned up, which resulted in 950 acres being returned for reuse through our brownfields program and others. Two notable examples: one, it was the River Bend development in Bend, Bill Smith's property, that actually received a national award for brownfields redevelopment. Also, Louisiana Pacific in Hines, that was an old mill site that was a brownfield site that is now being productive for a couple of industries that are out there. We currently have 463 contaminated sites in the system, and I would just stress that the cleanup is a partnership program. When I say cleaning up, I don't necessarily mean DEQ is doing all this work. Most of this work is done by the responsible parties and private contractors that they hire with DEQ oversight. For what is known as orphan sites, we do, in fact, oversee the work of contractors ourselves.
Madam Chair, did we add any more contaminated sites to the list in 2002?
The Dick Peterson can tell me precisely. I know that in the leaking underground storage tank, of which I neglected to mention, we also have 850 of those sites in the system, and we add about 100 of those per year.
Do you know how many of...
I don't exactly.
We'll get back to you on that.
Okay, but overall we are moving forward. I just was just curious. We see that what we've cleaned up, I wondered if
we can give you the trends over time.
Okay.
We're basically holding our own in solid waste. In 2001, 2.6 million tons disposed, 2 million tons recovered. And that is sort of a delicate balance between how the population grows and how much people actually recycle and versus how much they dispose. There's been a lot of change in that program over time, as I'm sure you know. We've reduced the number of, we're with only 35 landfills in Oregon now. Most of the smaller landfills have been replaced by transfer stations, and they're a total of, we have a total of 257 facilities under permit in solid waste, and we're monitoring 60 closed landfills to be sure they don't leak. We have 38 leakers at this point.
Sure.
Yes.
Steph, regarding landfills that leak, you've got all the old ones that have been in place for far back since the turn of the century, you know, and they are leaking. Some of them are placed for, you know, into the Willamette. What do you do about those leaking sites that are going to continue? I mean, they're going to continue to contribute. I don't see any way that you're going to go in there and make any change.
Senator Medjugorje, Representative Krieger, there's actually, I think it was last session or the session before, the part of the tipping fee that funds DEQ's solid waste program was actually directed by this body to go into an account that is dedicated to paying for the cleanup of these old landfills where you just don't know who was responsible for the problem in the first place. So we monitor, and when it or if it gets to the point where something really needs to be done. Some groundwater can move very, very slowly, and you don't necessarily have to react immediately. But when we do need to move, that fund has been set up and is there for that purpose.
Chair.
Follow up.
It just would seem that the volume of material in some of these is so large that in some cases it's been covered over streets, cities, bridges, over in Portland, for instance, the ones I know. They know what's happening. It seemed like it'd be almost impossible to really get a handle on it, even if you know you're going to go out and take out one of your major bridges, the freeway, I-5, to get at it, because that's where some of it is.
Representative Krieger, Senator Messerly, I can get back to you more specifically on where those 60 might be, because I don't know myself. I've been familiar with a couple in the metropolitan Portland area, but I'll get back to you and then what the approach might be depending on where they are.
Interesting. Thank you.
Stephanie, you mentioned groundwater contamination. Isn't surface water contamination also at risk in many of these, particularly in Western Oregon?
Senator Messerly, particularly in Western Oregon, absolutely, that we're equally concerned and sometimes more concerned about leaching to surface water.
And can you give us, do you have any information that you could give us a closer, more detailed update on that?
With regard to the leaking landfills?
Yes, the Western Oregon.
We will do that.
Okay. Thank you.
And then the last thing that I wanted to mention here on land quality, a little more positive note, we do provide that same tip fee that created the orphan account for cleaning up landfills also has a grant program for solid waste planning and recycling grants to local communities and also for the department to hold household hazardous waste collection days throughout the state, which have been very popular. Moving to page 12 and the operational effectiveness in terms of how land quality has been performing. The system, the Federal Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, has often been referred to as a cradle-to-grave act. The idea was for managing waste, you want to start from when it's generated until it's disposed and manage it safely throughout the entire operation. And that all obviously involves a lot of tracking and reporting by the generators of that waste. And so we have been working in this program on operational improvements to try and make it easier for them to do that tracking and reporting. We've also, in this program, partnered with the State of Washington Department of Ecology. There's a lot of waste that moves across borders, obviously, since we have the hazardous waste disposal facility at Arlington. And we worked with Ecology jointly to set up a data system and probably saved about $100,000 and were able to implement a system that we couldn't have done by ourselves. We've also, over the years, I mentioned that the initial cleanup program was in 1987, and then it was updated in 1995, where we changed the law to have cleanup standards based on risk, and having a risk-based, the shorthand version is having a risk-based cleanup can allow you to leave some materials in place, where prior to that change, it was really having to clean up everything. So that has made some streamlining to that program. And some of that contamination has been able to remain and be managed on site. We've also implemented what we call an independent cleanup pathway option for folks who have to do a cleanup. And we actually just review the completed cleanup, and rather than overseeing the whole process, developers in particular appreciate that program and will take advantage of it. And we're trying to, our goal is to have a 60-day turnaround for 90% of the time. And I've made a note to myself here to tell you we could use a performance measure for this one, because I realized in going back through the performance measures that we don't have one on that one. I think it's a good one. We also have a prospective purchaser program, which will provide some liability relief in the cleanup process. For people who want to buy a property and there may be some concerns about the contamination and liability, and we kind of go through a process with negotiating for everybody to make it a win-win.
Stephanie, on that note, I know when we were trying to bring Nucor to Coos Bay, the issue was that we had a program that if the land was contaminated, that indemnified the buyer, at least to some degree. The problem we ran into was that the land was not contaminated, but it had the potential to be contaminated, so it didn't fit. Is there anything been done to fill that gap?
Senator Mesereau, do you know that, or can you find out?
No.
I don't know the answer to that, but we'll find out. One other thing I wanted to mention is in our underground tank program, I know enforcement is not exactly something that everybody thinks of as a warm and fuzzy thing. However, we're trying to, by piloting a ticketing program in tanks, rather than have folks for relatively, if you will, minor violations, having to get into our pretty cumbersome referral and enforcement process, that we are testing a ticketing program here that should make it very easy for folks to understand what the problem is, what they need to do to fix it right there, and not have to go through a lengthy dialogue with DEQ about it. And if that works well, another obvious program where we could try this in is in the septic tank program. And the difference, one of the things I want to point out that we struggle with at DEQ is, and probably do less well at, is we are generally, as a state agency, not set up to deliver programs that interface one-on-one with individual Oregonians. And the septic, one of the reasons I think you all probably get lots and lots of complaint calls about the septic tank program is because it's one of those programs. And we continually struggle with how to do a better job because it takes different skill sets and it takes different processes. Underground tanks, to a certain extent, is also not necessarily an individual homeowner, but it could be a very small mom-and-pop grocery store or whatever. So part of our transforming the agency and all the other things I've been telling you about is to figure out how to run programs more effectively where they affect individual homeowners or just the regular folks in Oregon. And it's a challenge, and I think I've talked with all of you about, I think the floating homes in Senator Duke's area would be another example.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That raises a question for me, Stephanie, because I've had a contractor who works in both Clatsop and Columbia County complain that the regulations with respect to sewer tank installations are different in the two counties. It seems to me that your standards ought to be consistent county to county, should they not?
Representative Johnson, that's correct.
Okay.
And perhaps we could follow up on that for you.
It's enforcement. They're enforced differently.
I'm hoping somebody behind me is taking notes.
There's four of them, right?
Yes, everybody's scribbling.
Scribbling seriously. Any other questions on land quality? Okay, I am really close to being done with my part. I might even finish for you today. Slide or handout 13, I'm going to talk a little bit about overall agency operational effectiveness. I've been walking through for you on each program and how we've been performing. I just want to conclude here by talking a little bit overall agency-wide. Tab 9, Appendix AM3, I referred to earlier. This is the summary of the customer service survey. I'm not going to go over that in detail. Just want to be sure you know that it is in there. We've also, in addition to surveying our customers, we are on a program to provide customer service training to all the folks who work at DEQ. By the end of 2003, we will have completed customer service training for 300 DEQ employees, and we're doing that through Portland State University's Professional Development Center. We started in the septic program, and we're now working with some of our permitting staff. We've also tried, ever since the early 90s, the agencies.
Oh, she's interrupting, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following the directions that all of the subs have been given by the co-chairs to be combing through these budgets looking for savings, I'm just curious, if you're running 300 DEQ employees through the Professional Development Center at Portland State, give me the magnitude of that contract.
We have spent $14,000 so far, and we will spend another 20 if we finish 300. But we've not committed to that another 20,000 yet.
I would have a follow-up first. You say you're going to run 300 through that program. How many would you, is that total that you will need to run through the program, or do you have other classes that you want to bring through?
Senator Messerly, my opinion is that it ought to be all 800 of us. However, as Representative Johnson just pointed out, the budget may not allow that, so we are trying to be selective in who we are sending through the program to have the folks attend who have the most interface with our customers, and that's why we focused on the septic tank program and our permitting programs first, and then we would evaluate the need beyond that.
So those two programs are the total 300?
Yes.
If not additional, okay. Representative Morgan?
I think more of a comment, Mr. Chair, rather than a question, that as Stephanie has very correctly pointed out, that if you were to classify the complaints that we receive as state representatives, they're going to be in the two programs that she's targeted for customer service training, and I think that a whole lot of the issues that we have to deal with are people that think that they've been treated unfairly for a variety of reasons in the system, and that we need to think in terms of the ability of this training to speed up people going through the system, to get them through without getting them back into it, and to get them through thinking that they've been given a fair run through on the process. And I think it would be real interesting to look at, part of what we did in the last session was to request that the agency do customer service surveys to try to pinpoint areas where there were problems and try to point some paths through to make things work more smoothly than they are. And it would be interesting to see a follow-up survey after the program has been fully implemented for a year or two to see if it really has made a difference. And we should be able to gauge that, too, because our phone calls should decrease.
Representative Krieger.
Thanks, Senator Messerly, that this actually fits in with the conversation that you and I had last session about the agency being problem solvers, solution finders, working with people. And it goes back to what Mike Greenfield had put out in one of his reports about the agency people not being protectors of the statute of the administrative rule but provide service. And for that amount of money, how many people are going to be sleeping at night and not sitting and grinding their teeth worrying about some agency thing they're going to deal with? I think it's a very good investment of our dollar.
Morgan has follow-up.
Well, just to conclude what I was going to say, I think the agency's done an excellent job of grabbing a hold of the issue and coming up with a workable and realistic plan to deal with the problem that we gave them. I really commend what you've done.
Thank you.
I'd like to just point out that it's not just the personnel training, I don't think, that's at stake here. Sometimes the instructions are not clear as I think they could be. Their lack of clarity, and as in experience that I've had, sometimes there's not an approved equipment to allow the applicant to get through the process in a timely manner. So I just wonder, for the record and for the committee's sake, that it's not all just training personnel, although that is a big piece of it. But sometimes maybe state laws or administrative rules aren't in line to where the process works well either. So.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
just by way of clarity, I wasn't being critical about anything that fostered good customer service. Where I hear the number of complaints are counter fatigue, where people are just confused, frustrated, don't think they've been given a square shake by a polite customer service oriented person. So I didn't mean my question to imply a criticism of trying to make your people more responsive and better able to deal with stuff at the counter.
Thank you. I understood that, Representative Johnson. Appreciate it. And I'm so glad, Senator Meserle, that you mentioned about changing rules and things, because I'm going to get to that in a minute. Couple other things with regard to service to customers. I call your attention to tab 4, page 6, which has a map of where DEQ's offices are. We decentralized the agency in the early 90s, and by far the overwhelming response to that has been positive, because we have our field people who are doing permits and everything else out in the communities that they serve, and living and working with the people that they serve. And we've also, as I'm sure you know, been a partner through both the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds and Community Solutions team over the last 6 years in doing that. But the other thing I wanted to get to follow up on what we were talking about a minute ago, is in addition to the training by Portland State, the very first communication that I sent to my staff when I became the director, and this was I became the director in November of 2000, and March of 2001, I sent a memo out to all of them entitled Excellence in Public Service, and basically articulated the service standards that I hold myself accountable for and that I would expect from all of them. And I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but I would say that it includes a few things like returning phone calls within 24 hours, updating voicemail regularly so it's clear what the caller needs to do to get assistance, particularly if you're out of the office, respond to correspondence within 2 weeks of receipt. And one of the things that we've done is instituted in my offices as well, is they get an immediate response, that if there's a longer response coming later, they get something right away saying, we got your letter, we'll be back to you. Don't leave issues or problems hanging. Follow-up is key to agency and personal credibility. If you cannot solve a problem or provide an answer, direct the issue to someone who can. And there's a list of things like that. And then we went on as a management team at DEQ to develop what we call our communication credo, which is has been provided to everybody at DEQ who works at DEQ, and it contains things like, we listen actively and respect the opinions of others, we are clear and concise, we're honest about what we know and we don't know, we're personally responsible for following through on our commitments, we offer solutions, we focus on what's right rather than who's right. Those kinds of things. So we're trying to, I've been working with my team to set a cultural tone as much as the actual practical changes in the work that we're doing. And I just point out a couple other things on this particular page 13. We're also trying to make our connection through our electronic tools more effective than we have in the past. We've enhanced a couple of the aspects of our website. We provide a consumer corner that gives questions about things like wood stoves and septic systems and heating oil tanks and things that most homeowners have. We also did a radio campaign in Eastern Oregon, a public service announcement. It's called DEQ&A that had commonly asked questions about those things, and those were run free during news programs. We also have a Your Neighborhood feature on the website, a facility profiler. So we're trying to make the all the information that we have more available to the folks in Oregon. And I handed out this complaint response sheet. I'm not going to go over it. I just wanted to show you that it includes two sides of the page. One side reflects complaints mean two things to us. One is the complaint response that we do when people call in and they have something, you know, their neighbor's burning or somebody's pouring something down the drain or whatever it is. And one side of the sheet gives you some data on how many of those complaints we get and respond to. The other side of the sheet are the customer service comments that may be made about us and how we are attempting to come to grips with responding to that. We have the customer service survey, and that's the very last appendix in the big binder, and that's the little chart you see at the top. That's where that data comes from. Then in our vehicle inspection program, we've given out cards to the people who go through the program, and we also have given out cards in our leaking underground storage tank program, and we also did last year in the Roseburg office in our septic program we did, and we haven't continued that program. So we're struggling figuring out how to have an effective feedback mechanism. We have a very disparate population of people we serve, from very sophisticated regulated facilities to just a person who wants to put in a septic tank. So it's a challenge for us, but we are trying to do a better job of getting that kind of information so we can report it to you. And then my very last, second to last, the one that has stuff that I really want to convey to you today, gets back to the point that Senator Messerly raised. This is page 14. With regard to sometimes it's the rules themselves or the requirements that the department places on people. I mentioned Appendix A05 earlier, which summarizes some of our efforts to transform DEQ, and there's by program we have included a lot of information on specific things that we're doing. But more broadly, there were four key things that we have done, in addition to developing the strategic directions and the performance measures. And the first one that I have there is establishing a new internal process to evaluate carefully the need for rules in the first place. And you're probably amazed that we didn't have that before, but we didn't. So we now go through a very careful, deliberative internal process before a rule is even proposed to go to the Secretary of State or to go to the Environmental Quality Commission. There is already in place a very thorough public process for every rule before it goes to the commission. That's not the issue, in my view. The issue is, do you need the rule in the first place? So we have established a set of criteria that we go through as a senior management team where we evaluate the need for rulemaking. And again, I won't read you the whole thing, but we ask ourselves questions like, is there an alternative to adopting a rule to accomplish the same thing? Will the director be able to explain and defend the rule to DEQ's harshest critics in one of three ways? Directly addresses an environmental problem, keeps delegation of federal programs, makes it easier to do business with DEQ. Is the rule going to solve or prevent a known environmental problem, or are we just speculating that it will? If the rule is not solving or preventing an environmental problem, is there another compelling reason it needs to be adopted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And we have developed a set of criteria that we look at every rule that anybody comes up with at the department or is proposed to be adopted and evaluate it before we go forth with that rule. And I am very confident that we will be much better at our rulemaking and evaluating the need for that as a result of having that process. We completed an evaluation last year of how we manage our all the information at DEQ, and Helen Lottridge will talk to you in a little more detail about that when she is before you. She headed up that project. We came up with a set of recommendations, some of which we will be able to do and some of which we won't because of the budget situation, but it was a good evaluation, and I think now we know what we need to do. We just have to get there. We've also improved our internal accountability systems. We finally have an electronic time accounting system so that we can report to our stakeholders how we spend their money, among other things. We also, when I became the director, we did, even prior to all of the budget crisis that we found ourselves in, we did a complete evaluation of all the positions at DEQ. We eliminated 29 double fills that were not in accordance with GAAP guidelines. We terminated 23 temporary assignments. We resolved 9 pending classifications, and we updated a whole lot of policies about how we were going to do those kinds of things in the future or not do them. We're now in the process of completely redoing our performance evaluation system for the staff, performance management system, obviously in concert with DAS, because there are certain rules the state has to follow, but we've not been happy with how that works in general. And then finally, I also directed that our enforcement rules, Division 12 rules, go through a complete review. And that review has been done, and we're working with the external stakeholder advisory committee right now, and those rules will be out for public review and comment, and I hope you'll all take the opportunity to do that this late spring or early summer. One more. This is very brief. This is page 15. This is just my summation of the challenges that we face in 0305. I don't have to tell any of you that our natural environment is one of our greatest assets. And I gave Tim Hibbetts a call at Davis Hibbetts. It's a polling firm, before I came down here. And he said he's been doing polling for about 20 years. And consistently in his polls, Oregonians indicate that they want a balance between economic growth and a healthy environment. They're not willing to trade off one for the other. And I think that frames our challenge at DEQ perfectly. Our challenge for the future is to achieve our strategic goals and our performance measures, and also be a partner with a lot of other folks in providing a sustainable environment and a sustainable economy. And we're going to talk about those challenges a bit more. The fourth question that the co-chairs posed was what results can be expected from our budget. I have now covered question one, why we exist and how we've been performing. And Holly wants me to refer you to our performance measures in Appendix A03. I think I did at the beginning of the talk, but I'll do that again now. And this is the end of question two, how the agency has been performing. And Holly Schroeder, she probably wants me to go to this attachment, so I'll keep talking so she doesn't have to come up here and get started on the budget in the next 7 minutes. But far be it from me to suggest that. Holly is, in fact, going to be the person who walks you through the details of question three, how our agency uses our budget, whenever you are ready for her to do so.
Well, we take a break here and see, are there questions of the committee? Stephanie, I have a question that I was going to bring up earlier, and I didn't want to break in, but when you began your presentation, you were talking about that we built Oregon's programs based on federal acts. And my question to you, and you can bring it back at another time if you'd like, is that has Oregon, with our rules and regulations, gone beyond the federal law in any categories?
Senator Meserle, the short answer is yes. And I think the other short answer is, for on that other slide that I showed you of all the state programs that we adopted, one could argue that all of those are above and beyond the federal requirements. They're Oregon's own programs. They don't exist elsewhere. The Opportunity to Recycle Act, the Bottle Bill, the Toxic Use Reduction Act, all of those, groundwater protection, in terms, so that statutorily, yes, there have been, and those are not all obviously DEQ bills and laws. A lot of other people promoted those, and they were adopted by different legislatures at different times. In terms of our rules that DEQ adopts after the statute has, whether it's federal rules by reference or an Oregon statute, there are, in fact, some rules that DEQ and the Environmental Quality Commission has adopted that are more stringent. There have become fewer and fewer of those over time. I'm sure we can get you some kind of a summary. But I would say the short answer is by statute, it's the state ones that were listed on that slide that I showed you earlier, and then I'd have to get you a listing of whatever rules might be more stringent than the feds that we have at DEQ.
And I recognize that that might be difficult simply because I think EPA requires that the states have a program, but in many cases doesn't define very well what that program should cover. So it might be necessary, and this might get into pretty involved research, maybe have a how we compare with other states that are meeting EPA's guidelines. And don't misconstrue what I'm trying to say. I'm not suggesting that we reduce Oregon's requirements, but I am concerned, as I've told you and many others, of how our process works, and are we well? And many of the presentations we've had at the Full Ways and Means and other committees here throughout the interim, that Oregon is just a very, very difficult state to do business in, and that we're really struggling trying to attract venture capital. As a matter of fact, the statement we've heard is that venture capital is leaving the state at a rapid rate, and so that's where I'm coming from. What can we do? Is there anything that we could do to make it more acceptable for investors to help us recover our economy?
Senator, I do understand your point, and an example, I think, of a good thing that we did in that regard was last year, I think it was, or just the biennium we've just gone through, we specifically in our air program had an effort to expedite the permitting of the energy facilities, and I believe this body provided resources to DEQ for that purpose, and it was very successful and worked, I think, exactly the way you're talking about. I can't promise you I'll get you that information tomorrow, but we'll get it to you as quickly as we can put it together and try and differentiate between things that really are extra for Oregon versus, for example, the feds, when they delegate us air, they say you have to have a permitting mechanism to regulate, for the state to regulate, and then they leave it up to us to do it. So it's not like the permitting requirement is extra, but how we do it is maybe different from state to state. But we'll put that together, hopefully coherently for you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Stephanie, I appreciate your presentation today. I think it's been very well done and very impressive. And Polly, we're going to let you off the hook for the last 2 minutes of this hearing. Thank you for coming. With that, I'm going to adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 5018 and adjourn the committee.